Imagine the following scenarios. Your employer is hosting a party. You're expected to be there. Not being there might imply disrespect and could be a career-limiting move. You know there's going to be some drinking, there's going to be dancing. And what if it takes place during the Sabbath? Second scenario, you're invited to a wedding and a reception for a good friend. It's not in any way a religious wedding. What if it takes place during Sabbath hours? Number three, you're asked to work extra hours. It's going to take time away from your family and church responsibilities. Some of the work might include going into Friday nights. Four, you've been invited to go on a 3-day fishing trip next weekend with some of your non-church-going friends. From past experience, you know that some of the things they say and do will make you a bit, or perhaps a lot, uncomfortable. Number five, you're with a group of people who begin to discuss how evolution has much more going for it than creation. A few in the group know that you believe in creation, and they look towards you to see how you'll react. Number six, and the last one. You're with a group consisting mostly, but not completely, of Christians. And the discussion turns to one of the divisive moral issues. You can think of one, I'm sure. The non-Christians listening are starting to look rather uncomfortable with the direction of the conversation. You yourself don't share the more divisive opinions that are being voiced. Today we return to the occasional look into the book of Daniel. We're in chapter 3 today. Verse 1 starts out, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. 60 cubits and 6 cubits. It's about 90 feet high and 9 feet in width. Now, if it was truly, kind of like an image that shape, would be rather odd. Half of the height was probably the base, so the image itself was about 45 feet, but the entire structure from the ground to the top of the image was probably somewhere around 8 stories high. Just imagine if someone built an 8-story building in Petersburg. Would you notice? Probably. So this wasn't something that was done in secret. Now, it probably took quite a while. Everyone knew what was going on. Some people have speculated that, this was Nebuchadnezzar setting up an image of himself. Well, probably not. More likely it was Babylon's god, Bel, or perhaps Nebuchadnezzar was honoring his own father, Nabopolassar. Or perhaps it was a brand new god, a brand new religion that Nebuchadnezzar was trying to promote and set up in order to bring people together under one common belief. And although, now it says it was an image of gold. Well, it was probably not solid gold. The commentators will say that, not even Babylon probably had that much gold in its treasury. It was most likely gold-plated. Get to verse 2. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent together the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then, all of these that were just listed gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Repetition, emphasis and repetition. Now we see that. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of all the instruments that were just listed, the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This was a dedication service of the image. It was a worship service for Nebuchadnezzar's God, or gods. It was an attempt by Nebuchadnezzar to consolidate his power and to force acknowledgement of his greatness and superiority over all the other nations. By forcing acknowledgement of his gods as the greatest, it was an attempt to suppress any thoughts of rebellion. And just in case any really thought that their gods were more powerful and had the nerve to offer up a challenge, they would get a chance to prove it on the spot. Continuing with verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of and all the instruments listed before shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Let's say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Where was Daniel? The Bible doesn't say. There are a number of speculations, any of which could be true. Perhaps he was away on a mission, and he didn't get the email that said, "You know, the king wants you back." His cell phone was out of range. It was in a dead spot. You know, that backwards country over there. Or perhaps he was, you know, just simply sick in bed and had an excuse to stay home that day. And then there's this other one that I just learned this week. Now, the theory is that he was there on the plains of Dura at the worship service for Nebuchadnezzar's God. But the malicious Chaldean accusers wanted to take down the lesser three first. See, Daniel was too high, was too prominent. He had too much favor of the king. So they wouldn't go after Daniel first. They would go after the other three first. Once the other three were gone, that would have set a precedent. Then they would go after Daniel. Don't know. Speculation, but it's an interesting one. The accusers used the king's own words, his own decree, to remind the king of his decree, just in case the king had forgotten what was supposed to happen. Then the accusers add their own interpretation of the three Jews' actions. They mix truth and falsehood. What was true is that it's true that the Jews don't serve Nebuchadnezzar's gods, nor did they worship the golden image. What was false was what they added. They don't pay attention to the king. In other words, the Jews didn't respect nor honor the king. Well, how do we know that? Well, what were these three Jews doing here in the first place? Did they have a choice on whether or not to be at this dedication worship service? Probably not. But if they believed that their very presence would have gone against their convictions, wouldn't they have challenged their requirement to appear earlier? And being high officials in charge of the province of Babylon in which the plain of Dura exists, they couldn't have not known about the construction of this image. In fact, again speculating, but perhaps they were part of the planning and the construction of this image. They knew full well when they got the invitation, quote, invitation to attend, what was going to happen. They came. But they refused to take part in the actual worship. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, and so forth and so on, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" As soon as Nebuchadnezzar says that last statement, the conflict is no longer between the king and the Jews, but it's between the king's gods and the God of heaven. Step back to kind of get an understanding of Nebuchadnezzar's worldview. His worldview is one of multiple gods. Every nation, every group of people have their own god or gods. The power of each god is determined by the amount of territory the people and the god has to claim. Therefore, the conquerors have more powerful gods than the conquered. By conquering, more worshippers and territory are added to the more powerful god. The conquered aren't required to abandon their gods, but they're supposed to acknowledge the greater power of the conquering gods. Most of the people and nations and the Babylonian Empire also held to this similar worldview. So as nations gained or lost power, so did their gods. The more powerful gods ruled over lesser ones in the pantheon, or a celestial court. And since the Jewish nations, had been defeated, Nebuchadnezzar's belief was that the Jewish god was inferior and subject to Nebuchadnezzar's gods. He probably couldn't understand why the Jews couldn't simply add another god to their belief system like all the other nations did. Now, one might ask, didn't Nebuchadnezzar have a demonstration of the Jewish God's power through Daniel when he was able to give and interpret the king's dream, previous story here? Well, Daniel did demonstrate God's superior wisdom and knowledge, but God's power had not yet been shown. As far as Nebuchadnezzar was concerned, the Jewish God did not have the physical might necessary to protect and rescue his people. After all, weren't the Jews conquered? So when the Jews refused to worship Nebuchadnezzar's God, they were in effect challenging his gods. And so Nebuchadnezzar stands up and rises to defend his gods. But Nebuchadnezzar also realizes who stands accused before him. No, he really doesn't want to lose some of his best officials. Yet, he can't back down from his own decree, from his own words, can he? So he offers up a second chance. Verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Notice that the Jews' response is very different. When their God is challenged, they see no need to defend him. Their God is powerful enough and real enough to defend himself. But even if their God chooses not to defend himself today and rescue them, their trust in their God is going to remain. How much did they know what would happen to them after they died? What we have left in the Old Testament is that the Jewish concept of any sort of afterlife, what happens after death, was somewhat conflicting and vague. They certainly hoped for and trusted that there would be a world to come, but the Old Testament offers very little that is concrete. So we might say that their faith, their trust in their God, was that much greater given the uncertainty of anything that they might find beyond life in this world. Verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flames of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. The fiery furnace, from what we understand today, was like a big, I guess, a cauldron of sorts, with an opening at the bottom to feed more of the fuel, and an opening in the top where the people would be thrown down. And that's where the 3 were thrown down. And apparently, flames were just shooting high from the opening, so that some of it caught the people dragging the 3 and throwing them in. Nebuchadnezzar's gods, regardless of what their image and regardless of what their names given might be, are actually power and control. These are what he trusts. These are the things he worships. These are the things he believes he needs. And they're being challenged by the 3 Jews. Nebuchadnezzar's foundations of his worldview and beliefs are being undermined. What's left when the foundation is destroyed and crumbles away? What if you realized everything you believed in stood a chance of being destroyed? Nebuchadnezzar's reaction is actually quite similar, I think, to that of many people today when their beliefs are challenged. They try to dismiss, discount, ridicule, and do anything they can to get rid of the challenges and challengers to their beliefs. Most people today simply don't have quite the absolute power that Nebuchadnezzar had at his disposal, for which I'm sure many people are glad. Nebuchadnezzar uses his power and authority to dispose of his challengers. He knows of no way that the Jews could escape, but, verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king," they answered and said, "but I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." The God of the Jews chooses this day to respond and rescue. He answers Nebuchadnezzar in the only way Nebuchadnezzar understands, with a manifestation of power. To another king, to another person, God may have chosen to respond differently. But to Nebuchadnezzar, who only understands power and absolute power, God shows a power greater than any that he had known before. Some translations use the phrase, "the Son of God," capital Son, capital God, rather than "a son of the gods." But historically and culturally speaking, it's not quite accurate. because, remember, Nebuchadnezzar's worldview and beliefs would have interpreted this fourth being as an avatar, or a manifestation on earth of a divine being. Now, the capitalized Son of God is a later post-first century AD interpretation based on the belief that the pre-incarnate Christ made appearances on earth. While that may have been the case in the furnace, there's no textual evidence to prove that it was or it wasn't. So, if we're ever questioned on the point, we shouldn't try to use it. We shouldn't be very dogmatic about it. Continuing on with the remainder of the chapter, verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who had sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies, rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar experiences firsthand a power greater than one he has known before. The irony is that he misses the point God is trying to demonstrate. Nebuchadnezzar, upon realizing that, there's this God that's really powerful, issues a decree to try to defend the Jewish God from further harassment. Nebuchadnezzar still doesn't realize that the true God needs no one to defend him. And by offering the Jews a bit more liberty in their beliefs, a little bit more religious liberty for them, the King Nebuchadnezzar inadvertently restricts the liberty of others to speak out against the Jewish God. As we look at this story, what are some principles that we might be able to learn from this chapter? Now, there are actually quite a lot, but I'd like to mention just three today. The first is that the concept of worship is the central theme. Now, as mentioned in previous sermons on the book of Daniel, the underlying theme of this book is about worship, about true worship and false worship, and the conflict that is going to continue between them until Jesus comes to sweep away all false worship. In the previous chapter, the conflict was between worshiping wisdom and knowledge and the God who is the revealer of mysteries, who holds the keys to wisdom and knowledge. In this chapter, the conflict is between the worship of power and the God who grants power. Nebuchadnezzar worships power, and so when that's threatened, his whole world starts to cave in, and he begins to react in the only way he knows how, by exerting more force. The three Jews are at peace throughout this story. They don't even need or want the second chance offered to them. They know that any power Nebuchadnezzar has comes from their God, and their God can choose to intervene. They're also free. To worship anything less than their God means to submit under the lesser power and become slaves to it. They would rather die than lose their freedom. I believe people worship one of two things: things they trust or things they fear, and sometimes both at the same time. The second and third chapters of Daniel reveal two things that people trust and fear, and therefore frequently do worship: their knowledge and power. It was true then, and I believe the same thing is our worship today. I'm sure you don't have to think too hard to come up with some examples of where this might be happening. The question is, am I making idols of either or both of these? And are you? Second principle is that this world will always offer dilemmas to people who seek to follow the true God. This story can help us guide us in our response to these dilemmas and challenges. The three Jews in this story went along with everything until their allegiance to their God was challenged. Worshipping Nebuchadnezzar's image would have meant acknowledgement that his gods were more powerful and that their God was weak. It would have meant denial of their God. Again, a little bit of speculation here, but assuming that they were at least partly involved in the planning and construction of the image, as well as the dedication service, they may not have liked what they were having to do, but they did not see it as a denial of their God to do those things. They didn't consider their attendance at the dedication as a denial of their God either. These were just simply forms of a religion. But when the nature and character of their God became the question, that's when they took their stand. A principle we might glean then is that not all, or maybe even most, conflicts and challenges over religion, over theology, over worship, are worth responding to. Rules, regulations, and forms may define our comfort zones, but they may not be accurate boundaries of where we should be responding to challenges to our beliefs. This story tells me that I'm to stand up and respond when God's character and nature are being challenged, or when I'm told to deny who God really is. In other words, to lie about him. I also believe there are also some principles we could learn in how to respond and how not to respond. The three Jews did not try to defend themselves or their God. They simply spoke up about who they believed God is and then let God take care of the rest. The mistake many people, Christians as well as followers of other faiths alike, make is that when they see and hear their beliefs and religion being threatened and challenged, they take up arms to defend it, figuratively and literally. And the more extreme, well, take it to the extreme. The three Jews also displayed the utmost respect, honor, and courtesy to Nebuchadnezzar. Unfortunately, that isn't what is often seen and heard today in religious conflicts. The three Jews did everything they possibly could, short of denying their God, to work with and accommodate the circumstances they found themselves in. How many of us are willing to do that? I think the basic principles we should follow in responding to challenges to our faith is to try to find as much common ground as possible, to be respectful and courteous toward the other party, and simply state your beliefs without getting defensive nor going on the offensive. Third principle that I think we can learn is that we should realize that our God is a God of unexpected surprises. He shows up in places and works in ways that are beyond our imagination. Did the three Jews, in their wildest dreams, imagine that they would experience communion with a heavenly being during the pagan worship service? Yet that's exactly what they experienced. They chose to place their trust in their God Almighty, and in return, they experienced a Sabbath in the fiery furnace. They experienced both rest and rescue that day. The Sabbath commandment in Exodus 20 is about rest. The Sabbath commandment in Deuteronomy 5 is about rescue and deliverance. Going back to the hypothetical situations that opened this sermon, how should you respond? How should I respond? I don't have any answers, other than, it depends. There simply isn't enough information for me to provide judgments on any of them. how you and I might respond depends on where our spiritual journeys might be, our beliefs, our picture of God. How we respond depends on our relationship with the other party. How we respond is probably going to also depend on how others observing might be affected by your decision. What I do believe is that if we want others to respect and honor our beliefs, then we need to first respect and honor theirs. If we want others to take the time to get to know the things we value, I believe we need to prioritize building relationships over following rules. And finally, don't discount the places and times God might choose to make himself known.